funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the world change in 1959? Well, some historians consider the end of the Second World War to be the dawn of the modern era. My guest today will make the case that it actually started half a century ago, in the year that saw the release of the birth control pill, the invention of the microchip, the rise of Malcolm X, and the start of the space race. Fred Kaplan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who writes the War Stories column for Slate and contributes to the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times. His newest book is called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Fred, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
Can you start by talking about how you started to realize that there was something special about this particular year?
Well, it was sort of an accident. Many years ago, it suddenly occurred to me that a lot of my favorite groundbreaking movies, books, and record albums all came out in 1959. So, I began to wonder, well, was this just a coincidence or was something broader going on? And I sort of casually began to look into this question, and then more and more intensely as I realized that not only did a lot of very interesting and profound things happen, but the more I looked into it, the more I realized it was actually a pivotal year in American history.
Really a catalyst for what was to come, certainly over the next decade, but over the next half century as well.
I think that's right, yeah.
And in so many ways, it was a year characterized, and I'm paraphrasing here from the way you much more elegantly wrote it, that it was infinite possibility coupled with the potential for instant annihilation.
Here's the thing. On January 2nd of that year, the Russians launched the Lunik 1 space vehicle, which was the first rocket to break free of the Earth's gravitational pull and start to rotate around the sun like a planet. The next issue of Time magazine, which was sort of more hyperbolic in tone than it is today, there was a publisher's note which heralded the achievement as a, quote, turning point in the multi-billion-year history of the solar system, and that one of the sun's planets had at last evolved to the point where it could break free of its gravitational pull. And that's sort of what was going on all around us. It was also the year when coast-to-coast nonstop jet travel began, when you could take a jet nonstop across the Atlantic Ocean. If you read the press coverage at the time, this was heralded in much the same way that Magellan's voyages might have been heralded centuries ago. There was this overwhelming sense that we could master time and space, that we were breaking through those barriers, and I believe that created the conditions where we began to think that other barriers were ripe for transgressing as well.
It was a pivotal moment for race in this country. For one thing, the U.S. government began to make its first strides to sort of officially do something about racism.
Yeah, this is something that's been forgotten. I'd forgotten it myself. But in 1959, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, which had just been formed 2 years earlier, came out with its first report. It was a huge tome, more than 600 pages, based on investigations and probes throughout the country in dozens of different locations where people, mainly black people, testified. First time they actually came out in public to talk about things that had happened to them. And this was the first federal cataloging of systematic racial discrimination in housing, schools, and voting booths, and it led to some very important court cases in the subsequent 2 years that rendered many state laws about segregation illegal, that overturned those laws. It also influenced Martin Luther King to reorient his civil rights organization to emphasize voting rights. It propelled the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which started the sit-ins, and it also compelled a man named John Howard Griffin, who lived in Texas and was a active integrationist, and he was a white man, but he was very much in favor of integration, and he was a writer. He chemically dyed his skin to look like a black man and traveled around the South to experience racism himself, and he wrote a book, which you probably know, called Black Like Me, which to the extent that a lot of white people in America didn't want to believe real black people when they told them what was going on, they did believe this white man who experienced the same thing. So the sort of breakthroughs and racial violence that took place in the coming decade, that the match was sort of lit at the end of the 50s.
Yeah, Griffin's story is a really interesting one. As you mentioned, he grew up in Dallas. 59 was the year he did the research for Black Like Me. For one thing, he didn't imagine himself to be a racist until he sort of went through some of these things.
That's right. I mean, he grew up in a very segregated household, although it was, you know, like many areas outside the Deep South, it was sort of a genial segregated house. I mean, you know, they had black servants, but they were treated well, and so nothing was thought of it. And he went to a lycée in France for college, and he thought himself very enlightened when he, found himself sitting in classes with African students. But he was sitting having lunch one day and with a friend, and this black student sat right at the table next to him. And he said, "God, I don't know why I have to eat next to these people." And his friend, who was from France, said, "Why not? What's wrong?" And he suddenly realized, it hit him like a hammer, that, my God, what is wrong? He realized that he was actually more racist than he thought, and he set about to change that condition.
And ultimately, he sort of went through this experiment and was taken aback by the way he was looked at.
That's right. He actually, at one point during World War II, a bomb went off very close to him, and for a few years he went blind. He actually couldn't see at all. And he was very upset that people were treating him like a second-class citizen, although he was extremely well-educated. And that gave him some insight when he suddenly regained his sight a few years later. It gave him a new, profound sympathy with other undertrodden.
Malcolm X really came into his own in 1959. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, up until 1959, he was merely the head of the New York Mosque of the Nation of Islam. Nobody outside that very small movement of that had ever heard of him. In August of 1959, Mike Wallace, the TV newsman, ran a documentary called The Hate That Hate Produced. It was nationally syndicated. It played for 5 nights in a row, a half hour each night, about the rise of the black nationalist movement. And it focused a lot on Malcolm X. And Wallace's thesis was that the hatred that these people had for white people had been gendered by white people's hatred for them. And this came as a huge revelation, but it also turned Malcolm X into a celebrity. He started going on speaking tour. A lot of white people were terrified of the guy, but a lot of black people were quite drawn to him, and the movement grew, and it created, you know, that plus, that combined with Martin Luther King shifting directions and going off to India to commune with some of Gandhi's followers and coming back a devoted adherent to peaceful coexistence and civil disobedience. Those sort of created the two strands of the strategy to combat racism in America over the next decade.
Fred Kaplan is my guest. His new book is called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. I wonder if you can compare for us the shift in how whites saw blacks in the United States with the change in the way African Americans saw themselves and their own potential as of this year, 1959.
Yeah, I think, you know, 1959, civil rights wasn't really even much on any major political party's agenda. There was segregation. There wasn't even that much hope of integration. As I said, Malcolm X's whole strategy was to say, let's remain segregated. I think what happened was with these hearings before the Civil Rights Commission, especially, where black people got up and testified formally before a government official about what had happened to them, and then seeing the results of this, I think this created a sense of empowerment, a sense that maybe some kind of change was in the offing. And I think the generation of African Americans who came of age after that point was very different from those that came of age before that point.
superpowers as we define them in the modern world were still a relatively new phenomenon in 1959, but there was the first sort of bilateral meeting of these superpowers when second-in-command of the Soviet Union visited the United States. Talk about that trip a little bit and also compare what those sorts of meetings would have looked like before.
Right. Anastas Mikoyan, this is really forgotten, but he was the number two man in the Kremlin. He made a trip to the United States in January of 1959. He had a very serious purpose. Khrushchev had bluffed his way into a real crisis over the fate of West Berlin, and Mikoyan needed to backpedal, to soft pedal the idea that there's a Soviet threat, and the economy in the Soviet Union was in terrible condition. He had to do what he could to end the Cold War, quite an ambitious undertaking. But he came to the United States. He met with President Eisenhower, but he also went on this tour of the entire country, and it was covered as if he were a movie star or a presidential candidate. Nobody this senior from the Soviet Union had ever been in the United States before. It was a very foreign thing, and he was a very daft, debonair man. He'd been in charge of Soviet international economic efforts, and so had been to the West quite a lot. He didn't look like your typical, you know, shoe-thumping communist. But what this led to was the beginning of personal superpower diplomacy. Before then, the only meetings between the superpower were at these multinational conferences in Geneva with five or six heads of state or foreign ministers reading canned speeches and passing, you know, empty resolutions. And that was it. But by the end of the 50s, it was beginning to be recognized that the world had grown too small for this, that with jet travel on the one hand, but also intercontinental ballistic missiles where we could blow each other up in a matter of 20 minutes, the heads of the two major powers had to be in a position to talk to each other directly, immediately, and in their own places of existence. So and then later in that year, Khrushchev came to the United States and had an even more celebrated tour of the United States himself, and Vice President Nixon went to Moscow for the kitchen debates with Khrushchev. It was a new era when the superpowers realized they had to take more personal and direct responsibility for the fate of the world.
The Cold War, of course, didn't cool for some time after that, but do you think that was really the seeds of everyone understanding that we were, in a certain way, all in this together?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, even 2 years later, the Cuban Missile Crisis, it ended with a series of messages, secret messages at the time, between President Kennedy and Khrushchev, where they worked out a compromise to the crisis. And I think if there hadn't been these preceding meetings between Eisenhower and Khrushchev, where there was this precedent of the two leaders talking with each other directly and outside the framework of any international summit, it might have been much harder for Kennedy and Khrushchev to make contact, and the Cuban Missile Crisis might have been resolved in a much more violent fashion.
We'll talk more. We have a break coming up here, but you do have an amazing photograph in the book that we'll sort of use to tease this. Many of us have forgotten that Fidel Castro visited the U.S. in 1959. Can you talk about that picture that you have in the book?
Well, it's a picture of Fidel Castro eating an ice cream cone at the Bronx Zoo. People don't remember when Castro came to power on New Year's Day of 1959. He came to the United States a few months later. He was greeted as a hero. At the time, he presented himself as neither a communist nor a capitalist, somebody trying to create a third way. That turned out not really to be true, but it fed a lot of hopes. It fed a lot of hopes of breaking out of the deadlock of the Cold War. And, you know, the Bronx Zoo, people greeted him on the streets. He spoke quite fluent of accented English. He spoke before 30,000 people at Central Park. He wowed the American Association of Newspaper Editors. He went all around the country, and people thought this was the dawn of a new era in international politics. Again, that one turned out not to be so.
Fred Kaplan is with us. His new book is called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new, Details at smu.edu/think.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Fred Kaplan. He writes the War Stories column for Slate.com. He also contributes regularly to the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times. His new book is called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. 1959 was an extraordinary year in the arts on a variety of fronts. For one thing, it was the year of the first truly independent cinema. Can you talk about that for a minute?
That's right. John Cassavetes, who was a pretty well-known TV and stage actor, made the first film that was shot in the streets of New York completely. It was an amateur. It was completely outside the Hollywood system. It gained a certain notoriety, a certain amount of international prominence, but what its biggest impact was about 10 years later when a bunch of young directors at the time, especially Martin Scorsese, Robert Altman, saw this movie, which was called Shadows, and it inspired them to make the movies that they made, and it sired the American independent film movement as we know it. But it was an example of... another example of a cultural figure trying to break out of the orbit in which his realm of life had been constrained up until that time.
Talk a little bit about what made the movie so unusual. It was shot on a very small budget, which is an indie tradition to this day,
right.
And it was very much shot on location.
That's right. It was shot in the streets of New York, and you know, that couldn't have been done without the invention 1 year earlier of Kodak Tri-X film, which allowed filmmakers to shoot in very low-light situations. It was shot in... You can get this film now on DVD from the Criterion Collection. It was shot in, all over town, in the Museum of Modern Art Sculpture Garden, in Grand Central Station, in Times Square. If you remember those Times Square sequences from Scorsese's Taxi Driver, they owe a lot to the scenes in Shadows, and a lot of the dialogue was improvised, just completely improvised. So it shattered a lot of the structure of Hollywood and pointed up a completely new way of making movies.
Including the fact that there were no big-name stars.
No big names. These were all sort of aspiring actors who were in a theater workshop that Cassavetes directed in the Broadway district.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Vincent in Dallas. Hey, Vincent.
Hello. It occurs to me that 1959 might have been the publication year of the book On Thermonuclear War, written by Herman Kahn, who had the audacity, he was with the RAND Corporation think tank, he had the audacity to sort of look in the eye what losses might be in a thermonuclear exchange. And I think they came up with the name Dr. Strangelove really because of Herman Kahn. He was the person who enjoyed that.
You're very near. The book actually came out in 1960, but it was based on a series of lectures that he gave across the country in 1959, starting that spring. These were massive three-hour lectures, which drew thousands of people, in which not only did he talk about the dangers of nuclear war, but he posited some theories on how to fight and win a nuclear war. And you're right, Dr. Strangelove, that character, at least intellectually, his ideas were very much inspired by Herman Kahn. Stanley Kubrick had read On Thermonuclear War, even became friendly with Kahn, and all the stuff where he's talking about, you know, will the living envy the dead and surviving in fallout shelters. That came out of Herman Kahn, and the significance of that was, you know, some of my book is about the thrilling developments that were going on at the end of that decade, but there was also this deep and morbid fear. This was the height of what we thought to be the missile gap. People were digging fallout shelters in their backyard. There were Catholic magazines in which theologians held serious debates over whether it was ethically permissible to shoot your neighbor if he tried to break into your fallout shelter during a nuclear war. There was still atmospheric nuclear tests going on. Scientists were detecting hazardous levels of strontium-90 in milk. Herman Kahn was trying to work some way out of this deadlock, out of this stalemate. If there was going to be a nuclear war, does the whole world have to blow up as a result? He didn't do a very credible job of breaking out of that. It turned out that nuclear weapons were just more inflexibly powerful than anybody could control. But yeah, he was in a very different way from a lot of the other rebels that I talk about, certainly a key rebel of the time. There is a whole chapter about him in this book.
It was an interesting year for jazz, the emergence of free jazz for the first time, which sounded very much unlike what people had come to associate with jazz before.
Right. Charlie Parker had died in 1955. He had invented a new form of post-war jazz called bebop, in which soloists built their improvisations on chord changes and played very fast. And after he died, everybody in the jazz world was wondering, well, who's going to be the next Charlie Parker? Where is jazz going? And Miles Davis came up with this idea to build improvisations not on chords but on scales. And that sounds very technical and not even terribly meaningless. But what it means is that you don't have to be at a certain point in the song. There's kind of a series of deadlines when you build on chords. You have to change the chord, the series of notes, at a particular time. With scales, you can relax. You can focus more on melody, on mood. It doesn't have to be so fast. You can control it yourself. You can take it out for as long and as far as you want. And the album Kind of Blue is sort of the perfect statement of that. And it led to the kind of more mellow jazz that followed, both for better and for worse. But it allowed musicians to say, well, okay, I don't have to meet that deadline of the chord. I can play what I want to play when I want to play it and take the song where I want it to go. Now, it also raised the challenge. If you were a second-rate jazz musician, maybe you didn't have very much to say and you no longer had this compass of chord changes to rely on. But if you were a brilliant jazz musician like Miles Davis or John Coltrane or Ornette Coleman, you expanded the whole language of jazz. And, this wasn't just an esoteric thing. Kind of Blue ended up selling millions of copies. It still remains, 50 years later, the best-selling jazz album of all time.
Musicians of another ilk had Motown for the first time in 1959.
Yes, absolutely. This was Berry Gordy bought Hitsville, USA, his house in Detroit, in January of 59, put out his first hit in August of 59. This infused a sort of an urban blues jazz rhythm into pop. It kind of excavated us from the doo-wop Buddy Holly kind of rock and roll into a more urban and overtly sensuous, even sexual kind of music that the Beatles across the ocean then picked up on, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, and sort of picking up on a theme that you mentioned earlier, it was also an opportunity to really hybridize what had been thought of as black music with what had been thought of as white music.
That's right. It was really these songs that came out of Motown, that there was something called a rhythm and blues chart, which was sort of euphemism for black music chart, and it was separate from the pop chart, a.k.a. white charts. This fused the two. These songs went to the top of the pop charts. And I think it also provided a sort of lubricant for racial integration. I mean, how can you be a racist if you're slow dancing to Smokey Robinson?
And in the visual arts, there were really new acceptances of different kinds of art that before had been seen as sort of an outside thing.
That's right. Art was kind of getting very, very abstract. It was becoming famous, the paintings of Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, these abstract works on flat canvases. But a new kind of artist started emerging at the end of the decade, best represented by Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, who, although they borrowed a lot from the abstract expressionists, returned to the subjects of everyday objects. Jasper Johns painted American flags or numbers or targets, things that people saw but hadn't really looked at. Robert Rauschenberg, made these sculpture-painting hybrids that had just scraps that he picked up on the street on them. And this inspired a later generation, including Andy Warhol, and the other pop artists to return to things from pop culture, from tangible pop culture to base their art on. And it sort of brought modern art back into the fields of representation and reality, but in a very different way from, say, just the landscape paintings that had preceded it.
And then you had the case of Lady Chatterley's Lover.
Well, this was a very big thing. This is often forgotten, but until 1959, the U.S. Post Office had the power, and they regularly exercised it, to deem any book or magazine to be obscene and to prevent it from being sent through the mail, including, you know, to your house or from a publisher to a bookstore. In other words, they had a stranglehold on what Americans could and could not read. Barney Rossett was the publisher of Grove Press, and he set out explicitly to destroy this law. And the thing that he did, he published, there was an uncensored version of D.H. Lawrence's 1928 novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, that was been banned both in the United States and England because it had very graphic descriptions of sex. And he published this. The post office confiscated it, and he sued them. And he won the case, as a result of which the post office never did that again. Lady Chatterley's Lover, which is not, you know, light reading, became a huge bestseller. It sold 2 million copies in its first year of publication. You know, people had this pent-up appetite for forbidden fruit. As a result, it also paved the way for an explosion in freedom of speech, in daring freedom of speech. And today, if you look at the kinds of things that we see on HBO, Showtime, Comedy Central, that we read routinely, none of this really would have happened without this stunning court case at the end of the 1950s.
Well, you mentioned Comedy Central, and Lenny Bruce had a huge year in 1959.
That was the year that he rose. It was very, you know, again, there are all these things sort of converging in the same direction. Lenny Bruce was a stand-up comedian. Now, before him and a few others, you know, most stand-up comedy was a guy in a tuxedo telling jokes about his mother-in-law or, you know, maybe his psychiatrist if he was progressive. But Lenny Bruce unleashed these monologues about sex and politics and race and religious hypocrisy. And, you know, in 1959, he released his first record album, which was called The Sick Humor of Lenny Bruce. He went on national television, The Steve Allen Show, which was the forerunner to The Tonight Show. He and another comedian, Mort Sahl, I mean, they were making $5,000 a week in nightclubs, which was about what the average American earned in the course of a year. So, I mean, again, it was at this time when all these breakthroughs were happening, it created kind of a spiraling appetite for more and more breakthroughs and changed the way that we looked at life, changed the way that we live.
And talk for a minute about some of the things that were being written that ultimately would inspire what we think of as the sort of spirit, the zeitgeist of the 1960s.
Well, I mean, Norman Mailer had a book called Advertisements for Myself, which was a collection of essays, journalism, fiction, self-confessional essays, which sort of set the stage for the new journalism and the celebration of hipster culture. Another book was William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, which was also published by Barney Ross's Grove Press, which changed the parameters of how people thought they could write a novel. Allen Ginsberg gave a poetry reading at Columbia University, which sort of, I mean, I go into this in some detail in the book, but it kind of paved the way for the generation gap, kind of a whole new way, not of just of expressing, but of living and redefining what culture meant. And there were also a sociological essay by a man named C. Wright Mills called Letter to the New Left. At the time, there was no New Left. But at the University of Michigan, an undergraduate named Tom Hayden read this essay. It inspired him to write the Port Huron Statement, which became the manifesto for the Students for Democratic Society. So, I mean, there were all these. Basically, there was this growing self-consciousness this enchantment with the new, this notion that tomorrow was going to be something fundamentally different from yesterday. And I think, you know, the political embodiment of this was John Kennedy, who ran for president. The conventional wisdom of the time was that he was too young, he was too much of an outsider, but he ran exploiting those facts. He talked about passing the torch to a generation born in this century, to pioneers of a new frontier, and that new frontier he defined as the 1960s. We'd run out of space, but there was outer space, and there was the frontier of this new era that was upon us. So, again, there was, and I think there are lots of parallels with today, where we also have this young outsider president who talks a lot about change in an environment where we really are sensing that the ground beneath us is changing perhaps faster than we can even comprehend.
So there was a sense in 1959 that was sort of universal, that something was really changing. It wasn't something that sort of was noticed later on, that this had been this big year.
Well, in some cases it was. For example, a big development was the invention of the microchip, whose real significance took a few years to be realized. The same thing with FDA approval of the birth control pill, which, you know, unleashed not just the sexual revolution, but the feminist revolution as well. But there were some things, you know, coast-to-coast jet travel, rockets going up into space. It was a vague sense, but it was a very tangible sense nonetheless. That, and also the fact that it was the end of a decade. You can go back and read some very self-consciously aware ads, essays, and things like that at the time. Just looking at magazine ads in 1959, but not so much in 57, 58. There's a lot of ads that talk about the jet age, this, you know, jet age this, space age that. Countdown to tomorrow, and these are ads for, you know, things as mundane as floor wax. There was just this notion that was the way that you appealed to people, was that you talk about how new something was, whereas I think even a few years before then, the slower, more traditional, safer, you know, Eisenhower versus Kennedy. So you had this whole shift in what was appealing or thought to be appealing to a huge segment of the population.
Fred Kaplan is with us. We're talking about his new book, 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Fred Kaplan. His new book is called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Brink in Dallas. Hey, Brink.
Hi. I'm just wondering if Mr. Kaplan has looked into why the pivotal year was 1959 as opposed to 1956 or 1962. I'm guessing that the end of World War II would have been a major factor or contributor to such a pivotal year, and I'm wondering whether there's some magic to the fact that there's a 14-year span between the two, or if there are any other factors that played into that.
Well, I think you've put your finger on part of it. There was, one point of the book is that a lot of the things that we tend to associate with the 60s actually have their roots in the late 50s. And the instigators are not the baby boomers, of whom I am one, by the way, but rather the generation that came of age in depression and war and emerged afterwards, disgruntled or even rebellious at the sort of phony peace that followed, of the gap between their expectations and their reality. And I don't know if there's anything magical about the 14 years, but that is sort of the time that lapsed between the people who were still in control of society and politics and culture at the end of World War II, sort of faded from the scene, and these new people started coming of age in their 30s, usually. A remarkable number of the people who turn out to be my sort of heroes in this book were born between 1925 and 1930. So, yeah, I think that part of it is just this demographic shift and this cultural shift. But, again, I think it was also the sort of age of wonder that was developing in space exploration, in the jet age, and this notion that as we were breaking through the barriers of time and space, that other barriers could also be broken, and were in fact ripe for being broken.
A notable exception to the age of the people that were most of your heroes is Margaret Sanger, who actually was born in the 19th century.
That's right. It's a fascinating person. Margaret Sanger, who was this firebrand socialist suffragette who was getting arrested in the 19-teens for pushing education on contraception, which was then illegal. She later became the head of the Planned Parenthood Foundation. In 1950, she met a kind of a renegade biologist named Gregory Pincus at a dinner party. Said, "You know, I've always fantasized that there'd be a magic pill to prevent women from getting pregnant." And at the time, hormonal research was just in its fledgling state. And he said, "Well, you know, we might be able to do that." And money came in. She funneled money into this little lab that he had. And by the end of the decade, there was this pill. And it's a, you know, if you think about it, I mean, in 1962, Gloria Steinem, who later founded Ms. Magazine, wrote her first freelance article. It was in Esquire. And she said that the pill will create what she called autonomous girls, people who can take work, sex, education, and even marriage as they want, the same way men could. And, you know, I think along with the microchip and the jet passenger planes, I think the pill probably transformed life more deeply than anything that happened that year or any number of other years.
And the pill was not universally received as a wondrous thing. A lot of people were terrified about the way it would change sex roles.
That's right, and they were right. I mean, they were right to be terrified if their attitude toward it was one of terror to begin with. U.S. News and World Report and places like that had essays. Is this going to, you know, lead to an age of libertinism, irresponsibility? Well, you know, women could suddenly behave, not so suddenly, it actually took a while for the cultural shift to happen, but, you know, women could choose their own life. In fact, it's very interesting, the very first ads for the drug, which were in medical magazines, it showed the classical sculpture of Andromeda, the goddess who was chained to a rock by one of the gods, and it said, Andromeda freed from her chains. It said, since time immemorial, woman has been bound to by her reproductive cycles. Now with Enavide, which was the name of the drug, she can be liberated. You know, and clearly they were talking about more than just physical liberation. They were talking about, and they knew this, that they were, and Margaret Sanger knew it. They were talking about giving women control over their own lives and the kind of social change that would release.
It's much more interesting than the kind of drug advertising we have these days.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific ad, yeah.
Let's go back to the phones now, and we'll speak to Don in Richardson. Hey, Don.
Well, thank you very much for this interesting program.
Sure.
And I believe Mr. Kaplan said that Castro came to this country and was welcomed as a hero. And he certainly was, as I remember it. But for some reason, we didn't give him any kind of help. And so he was forced to, he didn't say this, that's my idea, that he was forced to rely on Russia. Is that the way you remember it, or is that true?
That's definitely part of it. You know, it's very interesting. At the beginning, you know, this is often forgotten. The United States was the second country after Venezuela to give diplomatic recognition to Castro's regime. The embassy in Cuba had no love for Batista, the dictator whom Castro overthrew. There was a lot of hope. But Eisenhower wasn't keen to meet Castro. In fact, the whole 5 days that Castro was in Washington, Eisenhower made sure that he was out of town playing golf in Augusta, Georgia. He did meet with Nixon, who was very suspicious of him. And I think you're right. This was It had very few resources. It needed some kind of protection. At the same time, though, given the realities, given Castro founded his revolution on economic independence, on land reform, on taking over, you know, on expropriating foreign-owned industries. Given the time, given the nature of U.S. foreign policy at the time, and given the plainly communist leanings of a lot of his advisors, I think that even if Eisenhower had been more receptive at the beginning, it probably wouldn't have ended well. Now, it ended much more quickly than it needed to, and much more harshly, and the Soviet Union was brought in much more rapidly, which led to, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis and many other crises of our foreign policy that I agree with the caller might have been at least softened, if not prevented.
One of the things I know that you did, Fred, in researching the book was go back and try to find some of the power players of the day, obviously most of whom are quite elderly now. Had they recognized the year before you brought it to their attention as being as pivotal as it was?
Some did. I mean, I don't know if the politicians did, but for example, Norman Mailer, whom I mentioned earlier, he wrote an essay in which he said something like, after a decade of stupor and complacency, I am detecting the whispers of a potent change, a rumbling for revolution. There were people, and, you know, here's one thing. There wasn't really the kind of national mass culture that we have now, or it was just beginning. So a lot of these changes going on in lots of different fields, the people in one field might not have known about what was going on in another field. You know, in the middle of the 50s, half the nation's households had television. By the end of the decade, about three-quarters. By the end of the decade, you know, pocket transistor radios for under $20 started to come into being. National television programs. So I think to some degree there wasn't as much specific knowledge about what was going on just because the instruments of mass communication weren't there. I think one problem that we have today, it's the exact opposite. We have such an overload of information. It's hard to know which of the millions of things that we know about, which half dozen or so are the transformative developments that might change the way we live over the next 50 years.
That's really interesting. So there are so many sources of shared culture that it's hard to sort of agree on what is
right.
Really...
And in fact, the shared part of that is fast vanishing. You know, people have their own bubbles and cocoons that they can go escape into on the Internet where they don't have to have any contact with anybody who disagrees with them or has interests in other subjects at all.
So, of course, this forces us to ask the question of what our grandchildren will think about 2009 when they're looking back on it in 50 years. Obviously, the Obama thing is extraordinary, but there are other things that will sort of fill in around that. Do you are you even willing to take a guess as to what some of the things will be?
Well, I can talk about it in general terms and compared with 59. What was going on in 1959 was a sense that the world was shrinking, you know, jet travel, ICBMs, that cultures were fracturing. You know, all of a sudden, the people that you never saw in places before were suddenly coming into public view. You know, Jews, homosexuals, black people. It was all changing. And science developing new inventions and devices that were both wondrous and frightening. And I think the same kind of thing is going on now. I mean, the world is shrinking. I mean, not so much jets and ICBMs, which we've known about for a long time, but look how, you know, how billions of dollars in capital can be just zipped from one place to another or halfway around the globe in a matter of seconds. This, as we know, is completely transforming our own personal lives. We see a connection to what's going on in other parts of the globe, even ones that we might never even have heard of before, affecting our daily lives. On the fracturing of culture, I mean, look, there is now almost not just a blurring, but practically an erasure between the public and the private, the spectacle and the spectator. You look at things like YouTube and Twitter. This is breaking down completely. And science, I mean, there are all these tremendous advances in biotechnology, but that are also possibly unleashing biohazards. You know, these advances in artificial intelligence, which some people fear might dehumanize us in the process. So I think you have the same kind of confluence of truly revolutionary developments going on. Where it all leads, I don't know. I think one thing that's useful about studying these developments of 50 years ago is that we can get a sense of where these developments were steered in productive directions and where they weren't.
Do you imagine the other parallel that I see is that we spent a lot of this decade being really afraid of sort of foreign terrorism as opposed to nuclear war? But do you imagine that we might be on the edge of another decade that is as turbulent and as difficult and as really upheaving as the 1960s were?
I think so, and there's one reason. At least in the 1960s, there was a structure to the international system. I mean, it wasn't anything we'd want to go through again, but the Cold War, the sort of division of the globe into East and West, at least provided a level of predictability, of some certainty. If you were dealing with a threat, you know who that threat was. It was a tangible state that had its own interests, and you could play on the fact that they had interests too. That was the basis of nuclear deterrence, that, hey, look, maybe you can blow us up, but we can blow you up right back, and you don't want that. So there's this kind of stability. Now, with the end of the Cold War, the implosion of the Soviet Union, that blew apart the entire international system as well. There really are no power centers, or, you know, one country might have a lot of power over another in one realm, but another country is in charge of another. And there's almost this sense of international anarchy. You also have stateless terrorists who might not be deterred because they don't have any territory that we could retaliate against. So in some ways, the coming decades might be perhaps not quite as apocalyptically terrifying as they were in the Cold War, when you could really imagine hundreds of millions of people getting blown up in a nuclear war, but where this kind of constant low-level edginess, nervousness, and violence just pervade international politics.
You were, I know, a very young child in 1959. Does it surprise you, even given your tender age then, that you don't remember more of what happened sort of firsthand?
Well, I was five. Yeah. I do remember very vividly the naming of the seven first Mercury astronauts. Maybe I think all little boys are excited by space, but I was right on the ground floor, so to speak. I do remember that. I remember a little bit about the first jet planes. Not much more, though. Not much more.
Well, you've got the book now, and so we all remember.
Yes.
Fred Kaplan's new book is called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Fred, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.